Hello, readers. My name is Jason Jefferies, and this is Bookin', brought to you by our new presenting sponsor, the North Carolina Book Festival, one of North Carolina's many amazing premier literary events. Happy to host North Carolina's many amazing authors, along with national and international bestsellers, prize winners, independent authors, and my guest today is novelist, screenwriter, and translator Katya Apikina. Her debut novel, The Deeper the Water, The Uglier the Fish, was named a best book of the year by Kirkus Reviews, BuzzFeed, Literary Hub, and many others. Her new book is Mother Doll, which is published by our friends at the Overlook Press. Katya, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me back.
It's an honor to have you here. And yes, this is a reminder for our listeners that you have been on before for your previous novel. So look that one up after you listen to this one, folks. And first, Katya, I last saw you right before COVID-19 shut everything down when you joined us at the North Carolina Book Festival, where you were in conversation, I believe, with Jeff Jackson. How have things been going these past 4 years? What have you gotten into?
Well, yeah, that was like right before everything changed.
Yeah,
I
like
was actually
4 days.
on my way. Yeah, I was on my way to a book tour in Europe for Germany and Spain. And I was literally on my way to the airport when I got the call of like, actually, we think everything is shutting down. And my husband and daughter had already gone ahead to Spain. And then like there was just that announcement that like you needed to come back if you wanted to get back into the country like immediately. So it felt very chaotic. But other than that, I wrote a book, I guess, over the last few years. I wrote most of this book during, I guess I started it right before the pandemic, but I wrote, you know, most of it during the pandemic. And then it was just, you know, like trying not to go nuts, I guess, like having it. A kid at home, we live in Los Angeles, and like they shut the schools down in the spring of when she was in kindergarten, and you know, they didn't reopen till second grade.
Oof.
So that was a lot. Yeah, she went to an outdoor school, and we kind of figured some stuff out, which was great because I don't think I would have been able to write this book otherwise. But yeah, I don't know. There, I guess a lot has happened in the world and in my life. But at the same time, it also kind of froze time in a weird way, the pandemic. So I don't know. I mean, what is time? I feel like that's one of my big questions in what I write about and just in my actual life too.
Yeah, right, for sure. Yeah, my son Van is in the second grade now. So he got, he didn't miss school as he started in kindergarten right when everything opened back up, but it was still interesting times for everyone. Well, thank you, Katya. Let's now dive into your new novel, Mother Doll. But before we get into the content, I want to know, what has the transition been like from working with $2 Radio, who published your previous novel, The Deeper the Water, The Uglier the Fish, to working with the Overlook Press and Abrams on Mother Doll?
Well, so for $2 Radio, I just like love them so much. And I had such an amazing experience putting out The Deeper the Water, The Uglier the Fish. It's a book that like still is somehow out there years later, which is just so amazing. You never know if that will happen or not, but that's like what you hope for. And that is in large part thanks to their work. And it's just two people, basically. It's Eric and Eliza. I mean, there's other people too now, but like it's, they really do like the bulk of everything from like designing the cover to editorial to publicity. They also like have a bookstore. They also have a restaurant, you know, they're just amazing. And I had like a really great experience working with them. With Overlook, I've also had a very good experience so far. It's very funny because I, when I was in college, I worked at Overlook as like an intern, assistant, receptionist type of person. But back then it was like very different. It was in like the early aughts, or like the, yeah, like the early aughts basically. So now it's part of Abrams, and I don't think many of the same people who worked there then are still there. But it is just funny to like kind of go full circle in that way, to go from like working as a receptionist at a place to having them publish your book and like take you to a Winter Institute. It's kind of like a dream scenario, you know? So yeah, it's been great. It's been great. Both experiences have been great. You know, my book isn't out yet at the time of recording this. It's still got like a few weeks to go. So I'm sort of just, you know, I'm doing a lot of like promotional work beforehand, which, you know, has been cool to get to talk to so many people, and hopefully, you know, the book will connect with a large audience.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much, Katya. Could you now take a moment to set this novel, Mother Doll, up for our listeners?
Sure. So in the book, Zhenya is in her early 20s. She's living in Los Angeles. She's sort of adrift. She came out to LA to become an actress, but it wasn't really her dream so much as like her friend's dream and her boyfriend's dream, who she ends up marrying. And it's in like 2008, so it's not exactly present day, but she's, you know, just feeling kind of at loose ends in a lot of ways. And then she finds out she's pregnant, which is not something that she and her husband had planned for or wanted. And it kind of blows up their marriage in a lot of ways, her decision to keep the baby or to stay pregnant. And she gets a call out of nowhere during this time from this medium who has been talking to her great grandmother, who is a revolutionary in Russia. And she, the great grandmother is kind of stuck in this sort of purgatory type space. And she's not exactly the great grandmother. She's kind of one particular part of the great grandmother that like the shame around her actions when she was a teenager, that sort of the great grandmother, her name is Irina, as an adult, you know, she continued her life. She moved to the US. She had a completely different life, but this was like the part of her life that she kind of kept hidden, kept secret. And it was like a shame that continued to exist in this kind of parallel world of the afterlife. And so anyway, she wants to tell her story as kind of like a confession to Zhenya, as a way of to be kind of seen, to be forgiven, and to be able to then move on out of this like purgatory state. And Zhenya receives this story through this medium, and it ends up changing her life also, to process this sort of ancestral trauma that she had been living with without even fully knowing or understanding what it was. And, you know, Zhenya really changes over the course of the book. Like, she starts off as a person who really feels like she has no agency and therefore takes like very little responsibility for any of her actions, to being a person who, I'm not saying that she is fully actualized by the end, but like, this is the beginning of her journey. She's very young too. She's in her early 20s. So that's basically the setup of the book.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much, Katya. This novel has one of the best first lines in recent memory, and that line is, "It was ironic that Zhenya and Ben would come home from spending time with people who had kids and be so giddy with relief and self-righteousness over their decision not to have any that it would make them want to fuck." And then in the next paragraph, Actually, let me read this part too. It says, they had just gotten back from seeing a high school friend of Ben's who was in town to fundraise for the Obama campaign and had brought along his whole family. I was watching this friend try to hold a conversation while also wrangling his toddler and switching off with his tense wife on something ominously called the baby's bedtime routine that made Jaina and Ben, now in their empty, quiet apartment, feel engorged with smugness. So Katya, can you tell us about your character's feelings here? And specifically, can you address this ominous baby's bedtime routine? As we mentioned, I have a kid and you have a kid, and I'm curious what your experience with bedtime routines is, both yours and others.
It's really funny. I mean, I think I was channeling, like, before having a kid, like probably long before having a kid, I was just so judgmental about other parents and like how they did it. And I think I like had ideas about like the quote unquote right way of doing things that were just like, obviously, as soon as I actually had a kid, it was just like, well, that's delusional, you know, like none of that is applicable or like relevant, you know? So I think the thing about baby's bedtime routine that's funny is it like looks so rigid. I mean, I think it can be very rigid from the outside, but I think like you have to figure out what works for you. And sometimes being rigid in that way is worth it because your kid goes to sleep at a reasonable time and then you have free time in the evening and then you have, you know, good sleep or, you know, whatever. So I feel like even if like from the outside, it's like, oh, why are they so uptight? Why aren't they like bohemian parents who just like let their kids, you know, do whatever? And it's like, well, because then you're stuck with like a very cranky kid who's like not going to sleep. And yeah, I mean, I think also like all kids are different and people, you know, can do whatever they want. I have no like overarching philosophy about it. I mean, not whatever they want, like obviously within reason. Yeah. But yeah, I'm trying to remember. I don't think we had like the most rigid bedtime routine when she was like a baby or a toddler, but we definitely had just like, you know, like the bath, the song, the book. I don't even remember. My daughter is like almost 10 now. So there's this like amazing disappearing memory thing that happens where I'm just like, I don't even know. I mean, her bedtime routine now is that she like reads for hours in the dark on her Kindle and we're like, go to sleep, go to sleep, go to sleep. That's her routine.
Yeah.
Now.
Yeah. That happened to my son actually, not last night, but the night before, where he just stayed up for like 7 hours reading. But yeah, he didn't sleep for the first 3 years of his life. So our bedtime routine was like very rigid. And like my mom would be visiting and she would be like, what is this crazy bedtime thing? I'm like, try not sleeping for 3 years and then we will talk about it.
Yeah. I mean, it comes from necessity. Like nobody usually wants to have a rigid baby bedtime routine. Like that doesn't sound fun, you know, necessarily, but it definitely can be worth it.
Yeah. For sure. Well, thank you so much, Katya. Shortly after this paragraph we just discussed, as you mentioned earlier when you were giving us a synopsis of the book, our protagonist, Jaina, is visited by her grandmother in a dream, or great-grandmother, and her grandmother at this juncture, and her immediate response upon waking is to call and make sure her grandmother is still alive. Can you tell us more about this feeling that Jaina is having in this moment when she needs to call her grandmother and see if she's still alive? And is this something that you, Katya, have experience with, this type of feeling?
Yeah, so Jaina and her grandmother, Vera, not her great-grandmother, right, but her grandmother, Vera, are very close. Like, she grew up with her. Her grandmother was, like, very nurturing, and they had a very, very close relationship. And during this book, her grandmother is living in Boston and it is by this point like very her health has really deteriorated and she's not in a conscious state, in a very conscious state. So when Jaina has this like feeling of her grandmother visiting her, I think it feels like, oh, it feels so present. She thinks her grandmother must have died, or this is some sort of visitation. And I will say that, like, after my paternal grandfather died, but it wasn't like immediately after, he did visit me in a dream, and it felt very, like, it felt very comforting, very nice to have him visit me. It felt very much like not a dream about him, but his presence was just in the dream with me, and it was a very nice feeling. And then when I was writing this book, my maternal grandfather, who I grew up with and was very close with, and I was with him in his last weeks, I was recording actually his memoirs. He was dictating his memoirs to me from the hospital bed in his last days. And after he died, I really wanted to feel his presence, and I didn't. And I was complaining about that to someone. This was like months later. And that night, after complaining about it, his voice just appeared in my ear. And it actually really scared me. Like, he just said my name, and I immediately woke up because I think I wasn't ready, you know, for some reason. So yeah, I think, like, for me personally, like, I've never seen ghosts. I've never, you know, like, I've never had that type of contact with the supernatural. But I have felt it through dreams. So I think that maybe is where this is coming from. And also, when you're, like, very deeply connected, like, for example, growing up, like, my mom and I were very, very close. And I did feel like if something was wrong or something was happening, it did feel very much like we'd wake up in the middle of the night, you know, just knowing that something was going on. That type of, I don't know if that's like a psychic connection or whatever you want to call it, but I've definitely experienced that with people I feel very close with.
Yeah, absolutely. I had a string of dreams over a few years of my life where I would dream of an old friend or acquaintance or something, and I would wake up and find out they were dead. And yeah, and you know, then later I had a dream about one of, like, the man who taught me how to play music when I was a student. And I was like, oh no, when I woke up, of course. So I went and I tracked him down on the internet, find out, and he's alive, and now we've established like a great friendship again. So you know, that's my story with that kind of thing. So thank you very much, Katya. Listeners, we're going to take a break here to hear about Libro FM audiobooks. And then I will be right back with Katya Apikina. The Book and Podcast is sponsored by Libro FM Audiobooks. Libro FM lets you purchase audiobooks directly from your favorite local bookstore, Quail Ridge Books. You can pick from more than 100,000 audiobooks, including New York Times bestsellers and recommendations from booksellers around the country. With Libro.fm, you'll get the same audiobooks at the same price as the largest audiobook company out there. You know the name. But you'll be part of a much different story, one that supports community. Listeners of Bookin' can get a 3-month audiobook membership for the price of one. Go to Libro.fm, that's Libro.fm, and enter Bookin', Bookin, in the promo code space. With each listen, take pride in knowing that you're supporting local bookstores. I'm back with Katya Apikina, author of Mother Doll, which is published by our friends at the Overlook Press. Katya, Jaina and Ben's first date shortly after the Twin Towers collapsed involved a video store. On September 11th, I was an undergrad. I had no idea what was happening. There was a new album by a band coming out that day that I wanted to get. So it was a Tuesday. So I drove to Best Buy to get the album. And then I think my friend and I went to Blockbuster Video to rent The Sopranos or something. And that's my story. So a video store, when the Twin Towers Bell resonates with me. But circling back to Jaina and Ben's first date, how long do we have left, Katya, when video stores are a point of reference that people understand? And what is your experience with video rental stores?
Well, they go on a date to Kim's Video, which it's possible is still around in New York. I don't know. It was like a very special type of video store where they had, you know, like really esoteric and interesting selections. And I remember I went to Columbia. I was also in New York during September 11th. But I was very far uptown. So I remember I wasn't at the video store. I went to class and I sort of was late. It was like close to the beginning of the semester. I think I had like just switched into this class or something, because there's like a period where you're choosing classes. And so I hadn't been there before, and I was just kind of like confused where I was going, and it was sort of late. And I just got to the classroom and there was no one there. And so I assumed I messed something up. And then I was in the elevator with someone, and I asked them like, oh, do you know where that class moved to? Oh, it probably was canceled, because I think they said because of the bombing, or something like that. And they just got off the elevator, and then I just was like, what the hell? And so I went outside. I was trying to call, but all of the phones were short circuit, you know, like all circuits were busy. It wasn't working. My parents at the time were like on vacation out of the country, and I think they were supposed to fly back that day actually. And so they, you know, they were, I think, like as a result, like stranded a little bit in Turkey. And it was just, you know, it was so unreal, basically, all of it. But yeah, I don't know. It's like something, it was very strange too, because I felt like I was new to New York. So like people would always talk about like how different New York was before and after September 11th. But like, I didn't really have that as a frame of reference. I only really knew it after, you know? And I lived uptown, so I felt very like, it felt, even though it was like, actually, if you went up on the roof, you could probably see it. For some reason, I felt like it was somehow like, I don't know, like not morally right or something for me to be gawking at it, because I didn't feel like a stake in it. I mean, I obviously did feel like some stake in it, but you know what I mean? Like, I was new to the city. This didn't feel like my city. I didn't feel like kind of ownership over it. And I didn't, you know, I remember people went downtown right away to like go look. And it just felt kind of like, oh, I don't think I can do that, you know, which I'm not like saying that it was immoral to go look or to, you know, but it just felt, I don't know, it was like a very strange experience. But I don't think I answered your video store question,
that's quite all right.
Which is unrelated, but there is a new video store, and I live in Los Angeles, that just opened up like right down the street. And it's like, you know, I think video stores are having like a bit of a resurgence, or like as sort of like a, oh, isn't this like a strange thing that people used to do sort of thing. And it's also like a theater, so it's not only a video store, but like I took my daughter there and we like rented a DVD, and it was like very exotic and strange.
Yeah, there was one of those in Raleigh, North Carolina, at the Alamo Draft House Cinema, I think, that has, they have videos and things that you can rent. And yeah, on September 11th, I remember the Blockbuster video clerk shaming us for wanting to rent things. And we had no idea what was going on. And he's like, all right, look, he's like, Twin Towers down, Pentagon down, and just gets like, you know, filling us in on what happened. And then, of course, we went home and watched the news, and eventually we're thankful for having a video, because, you know, it's just this video, this image of the plane flying into the towers over and over and over and over again. But back to video rental stores for a moment, Katya. Do you think we have lost something by not being able to go to these whenever we want, or Camelot music stores in the mall or wherever, and kind of dig through these bins of media where we may buy something based on the cover or on the description of the back of a box? Or is it better, in your opinion, to have everything at our fingertips all the time?
Well, it's definitely more convenient to have everything at our fingertips all the time, but I think like the price is very high for, you know, the trade-off of the attention is not worth it. But I don't know that you can like necessarily go back. But yeah, I feel like being able to just go to a store, pick the thing you're going to watch, go home and watch it. You know, that was so normal before. And now, you know, that's not usually people's experience. There's like a lot, but I guess, you know, whatever. Before there was like channel surfing, and now there's like the equivalent of that with our attention, you know, where we can go between things. But yeah, I don't know. I feel like definitely there's such a pleasure in just object in physical objects, you know, and like holding something in your hands and like understanding it in that way. I feel that way about books. I feel that way about other media. But at the same time, you know, I read digitally all the time. It is like convenient.
Yes. So. Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much, Katya. In the next chapter of your book, there is a passage towards the beginning that reads, "Obviously, it was the work of many men like me, but together we short-circuited entire Soviet apartment buildings. The key was to organize," end quote. And Katya, I want to talk about the importance of organization in this manner. This interview won't appear for, I don't know, a couple of weeks, 2 or 3 weeks, I think, after this is when your book comes out. And by that time, I will have escaped, I hope, this weird situation where I'm currently working for a bookstore owned by this culty nonprofit that is very anti-union. And I'm seeing the effects of that now, their fear of organization. How important is it, Katya, in the specific context of your novel and in general, that people organize?
I mean, I think it is important. Well, in the context of my novel, it's a little weird because that quote is being taken from this ancestral cloud of grief that the medium is like kind of wading through to try to find. He's a pet psychic, and he's trying to find like a specific Pomeranian that's named Coco, and. To give you all that as a backstory, so that quote is like it's kind of like hard to take it from a different context, but yeah, it's also, you know, the character of Irina, the great grandmother who is in that cloud and who's telling her story eventually to this pet psychic. She joins the revolution and is involved in the Russian Revolution, so. I don't know that her kind of motivations for it are, she, you know, there's like a very strong dissatisfaction and reason to be dissatisfied with the Tsar. And there's just a mass movement, which I think, which she wants to be part of and which she's part of. I think like what ends up happening after the revolution and the civil war that follows and stuff is not really like, there's just so much collateral damage, you know, and then having left the Soviet Union, you know, it was not this utopic place that it was originally trying to build. But I do feel like that impulse, you know, but neither was Imperial Russia, you know, there's a reason that it was overthrown. It was like deeply unjust. So, yeah, I don't know, but I think in terms of just like, or you know, people have a, you know, it is that there's a strength in a collective voice, and I think that's also like a theme in the book where she is like at one point at a protest, you know, and just that feeling of like merging with other people towards a greater goal. It's a very powerful thing to experience and to, you know, I think it's like a human drive to want to be part of something bigger than yourself. And like, obviously it depends what the thing is that you're part of that's bigger than yourself. If that thing is, that thing can be positive or negative, you know, but that desire to be part of something is very, I think, human and deeply relatable for me too.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much. Is this book, Mother Doll, a ghost story, Katya? And do you believe that self-deception exists even in death?
You know, it's funny because when I was seeing like kind of the way the book was categorized, it was listed as like, yeah, like a ghost story. And I was just like, oh, well, I guess technically it is. There is a ghost in it. So I guess that makes it just by default a ghost story. I think when people hear ghost story, they're probably going to expect something very different. Because it reads very, it's like, it's funny and it reads like it's real, you know, like it's very realistic. I guess I don't know. I don't know what the expectations necessarily for ghost stories are, but my instinct is it's probably not this, but it is like about, you know, intergenerational trauma, and it is about, and I think a lot of ghost stories, you know, are about that too. People in ghost stories are lingering because for a reason, you know, it's not like they had this like satisfying, happy life and they decided to stick around usually. There's like some sort of deep pain that makes them stay on, I think, in most ghost stories. But I don't know. And as for like lying to yourself, even in death, like I think, sure, like why would it be that different? Why would it be that different, you know? I mean, I guess you would have like a, I don't know what life is like after death, so it's a little hard, or
Don't.
if it exists. But it's a little hard to know how that would, if like change is possible. But I would assume that you're sort of, at least the way that I've kind of presented Irina, it's like change for her is not really possible. Like she is really stuck in her understanding of herself, her pain, what happened to her. Whereas Zhenya is alive and able to change through the course of the book, you know, and is able to heal that aspect of herself, you know. I think like one thing that I thought found interesting in like writing and thinking about this idea of like afterlife and like what persists is like thinking about yourself as consisting of many parts, you know. And so we think of ourselves as like this coherent self, but really, I don't think that's true. You know, I think we have many parts to ourselves, even just like the physical body. If you think about it, there's so many organisms living in us, like bacteria, like gut bacteria, for example, that can like change the way that your brain works and the way that you perceive reality, right? I mean, all of these things. It's like we're just like a sack of bacteria walking around having these like experiences that we think are somehow true. We think of somehow like we have access to objective reality, which like, you know, we don't. And we think that we have like that there's like some sort of that it's also we think of it as like static as opposed to constantly changing, which we are. So I think, you know, it's like the thing with your eyesight, right? Where your brain edits out your nose, which, you know, it sees constantly and just edits it out. You know, I think there's just so many things like that where we think we're seeing things as they are, but we aren't, you know. And I think that in death, I don't know why that would be any different. If like a ghost continued to exist, why it would be somehow wiser necessarily, but maybe it would be. I don't know.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you so much, Katya. Finally, and listeners, we have barely grazed the surface of this wonderful novel, which is sure to be one of the best of the year. Katya Apikina is one of our best young writers. I've nominated her for a major prize myself, and I have no doubt that she has such a prize in her future. If you haven't read her, you are doing yourself a disservice. Please rush out to your favorite local independent bookstore and buy both of her novels now. And if you don't have a favorite local independent bookstore, order them from our friends at Page 158 Books in Wake Forest, North Carolina. But finally, Katya, Zhenya, our protagonist, calls an acquaintance of hers the Tin Man because she got the feeling that he didn't have a heart, a deficiency, you write, that probably fueled his interest in cardiology. And then you write, don't we all want to study and understand what we lack? And Katya, I'm hoping you can unpack this statement for us, both from Xenia's point of view and your own, do we all want to study and understand what we lack? Why or why not? And what are the positives and negatives of this approach?
Yeah, what a good question. Absolutely. I mean, I think that's like the main motivation that I have for writing. It's like in the writing is the understanding, like in the process of the writing is how I understand things. So I'm often writing about characters who are just think and act very differently from myself, you know, because I'm curious to understand what motivates people, how, you know, how people justify certain behavior to themselves. I think I have a lot of empathy for my characters, you know, and I think I can, you know, I might as a person like have judgment about their behavior. Like if Zhenya was a person in my life who I was like on the receiving end of some of the stuff, I wouldn't be like just like so zen and, you know, like necessarily as empathic as I'm able to be when it's like a character that I'm writing. But, you know, it is about writing and reading. It's about having that, it's about developing empathy rather than judgment. Not just being like, they're good, they're bad, but just like trying to understand why, you know, why do people do the things that they do? How do they like perceive the world? It's wild to think about how differently every person perceives reality. You know, my first book, it's about two sisters and a family, and they have such wildly different experiences of the same events, of the same family. And, you know, I think that's just often the case. Like, none of us really experience things in the exact same way. Or, like, you know, you get certain sort of data points from the outside and you create a story from them for yourself, you know, and there's just so much that you have to usually fill in because you don't really know what another person's experience is like, what their motivations are like. So I'm just fascinated by that. And that's like why I write. That's why I enjoy it and why it's meaningful to me. And I mean, I guess another reason too of why I write is like, I want to create a specific emotional experience for someone else, you know? And as a reader, you know, you're projecting your life experience into the story. You're bringing your capacity for empathy and various, you know, emotions that you had attached to certain experiences to a story. And you're sort of filling that in. And that's why reading is so powerful for like each individual person. As for Zhenya, I think, yeah, I think so. The character of the Tin Man or Anton is like a character who ends up having a bigger significance as the book goes on. She doesn't really like initially, they're involved, and initially, she doesn't really see herself as like having any sort of power in the relationship, and she doesn't really entirely understand like what he wants from her, and that relationship develops as the book goes on, and he and his wife also become important characters in the book.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for that answer, Katya, and thank you for writing this wonderful, wonderful book. Listeners, I've been speaking with Katya Apikina, author of Mother Doll, which is published by our friends at the Overlook Press. Katya, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me. This was so fun.
Once again, I would like to thank Katya Apikina for joining me. Copies of Mother Doll can be purchased from your favorite local independent bookstore or downloaded as an audiobook from Libro FM Audiobooks. I would also like to thank Libro FM for their sponsorship. Please navigate over to Libro.fm and enter the promo code BOOKIN, that's B-O-O-K-I-N, in the promo code space to get one free audiobook and support your favorite local independent bookstore in the process. My name is Jason Jefferies, and this has been